There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Good evening. You're listening to the Business Breakfast Nightcap. Coming up, we get an oil price prediction from a man who should know better than most. We look back on the life of the designer Karl Lagerfeld with the editor of Vogue Arabia, and we find out how a UAE company is making serious money from a promising TV series. But first, Mark Cutis is the CFO of ADNOC, the Abu Dhabi National Oil Company, to discuss why they deserved an excellent credit rating from Fitch, the big ratings agency out of the UK, AA+.
Fitch did extensive work when they came in to look through our books and records. And they looked at our reserves, they looked at our profitability, they looked at our underlying capital strength, and they looked at the enormity of the programs, but our ability to finance them. So doing all this complex calculations and work, they came to the conclusion that we deserved a AA+ rating.
Talk to us through your links to the Abu Dhabi government and really how much Fitch linked your rating to the reference point of the Abu Dhabi sovereign rating.
Well, I mean, I would say that a lot of what happens in the economy of Abu Dhabi is driven by the enormity of ADNOC's contribution. So, you know, for them, the issue was how strong are our links to the government in terms of us handing over our surplus to them. And I think they were comfortable that there is very strong governance between ADNOC and the government, that we're not just a receptacle for, you know, for forwarding funds to them. So they felt very comfortable with our position and how we managed our finances.
But I've always sort of imagined that most of your sort of surplus money that you're not using for operating purposes does go to the government.
Absolutely. Right. That's the government is the shareholder, yeah. And therefore you return the funds to the government.
What does this positive rating do for ADNOC in terms of access to capital, access to cheaper money, and of course reputation?
Yeah, that's the key question. I mean, the first thing is that it validates our underlying creditworthiness, which a lot of our counterparties knew implicitly. For instance, the international banks, they rate us internally with their shadow credit ratings at the highest rating. It's comforting for them to see that a third party that is not linked to their business, to the bank's business, is actually giving us an independent rating. So it validates that we are one of the strongest credits. That's number one. Number two, it sends a signal to the broader community that we manage our finances well and that we're a conservatively run company that has access to credit. And number three, because of the enormity of the programs that we're undertaking, it's also a signal to the broader community that we're a well-run and well-managed company.
We've got lots of questions coming in. Let me throw a couple at them. Many of them are about ADNOC distribution, the petrol stations. Now, I know that's a very small bit of the organization that you're the CFO of, but nevertheless, people are interested. They use it all the time. Here we go. Someone writes in, for a profitable company, how come you're charging people 10 dirhams to fill up their car with gasoline or petrol? And also thoughts on Kafru, which is the petrol delivery business that takes petrol to people's homes rather than us going to fill up at one of your stations.
Well, first of all, I wish John Kerry, which the deputy president, was here, because this is kind of his remit and he would answer it effortlessly. But at the end of the day, the issue of what we charge people at the pump, they have, you know, consumers, including myself and my wife, you know, you can pump your own gas, so you don't necessarily have to pay the 10 dirhams. So I'm not sure I can say more than that, or I know more than that.
Someone else writes in, Irfan wants to know about your projects overseas, especially in Pakistan and India. What are your plans there, and why would you be expanding into places like Pakistan and India?
Well, if you think about when you make investments, you know, proximity defines investment appetite to a certain extent. And those are countries that are near where we are. So, and those are countries that have, they need our oil supplies, or they need oil supplies in general. So it makes sense for us to reach out and look at doing constructive sort of relationships with these countries to supply them with oil on a long-term basis.
And just remind us what it is you're doing in India and Pakistan, or talking about doing.
Yes. Nothing has been done. We've signed various memorandums of understanding, and we're working on different projects, but nothing really yet has taken shape. But it's essentially providing oil on a long-term basis in terms of putting it, you know, putting it through into refineries and related businesses.
Another question coming in about people. It's one of the four pillars of the new ADNOC under your CEO, His Excellency Sultan Al Jaber. And the question is, how is ADNOC balancing the need for emiratization with ensuring a performance culture?
I think one is not mutually exclusive from the other. So any company has to focus on the performance culture to make sure that it's that the people are performing at their kind of peak capability. So that's something that our CEO, Dr. Sultan, is always focused on. And as far as emiratization is concerned, you know, that's a long-standing objective, which year in, year out, we increase the percent of emiratization. And it makes sense if you think about it. You live in the UAE, the bulk of your employees should be locals.
Look, we on the Business Breakfast, I mean, we talk about the oil market, but I guess our understanding of the oil market is probably limited to stories that we read, reports from Baker Hughes about rig counts and things like that. And it was reported last year that ADNOC is talking to Baker Hughes about an investment and possibly some, not just an investment into rigs, etc., but also into the company as well. Has that taken place?
Yes, it's taking place. Yes, that took place, yeah. And it was signed several months ago. And Baker Hughes, which is a great company, they came in and they acquired 5% of ADNOC Drilling. And what they've done is, you know, they're injecting their people, they're injecting their expertise, and they're injecting their knowledge of other marketplaces. So that's a good example of the collaborative type of relationships that the institution is trying to put together around the world to bring in, again, DNA, capital, and expertise.
Mark Cutis, the CFO at ADNOC. We look forward to having you back in the studio again.
Thank you for having me.
And congratulations on your AA+ rating from Fitch.
Thank you.
The Business Breakfast Nightcap.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hey there, we are The Business Breakfast. Welcome to our Nightcap. Now we're going to get an oil price prediction from a man who makes it his living. Dave Ernsberger is global head of commodity pricing at S&P Global Platts. But we started talking not about oil, but about precious metals.
Precious metals are always the first to respond to a big trigger event in the general geopolitical space. And we see with a lot of the back and forth between the U.S. and China, the trade wars that are going on there, they ebb and they flow. But the general persistent uncertainty associated with that in the macro global space, plus some regional issues, particularly in Europe with Brexit, we're only, what, 6 weeks away now, 5 weeks away from a potential big trigger date there, that will spur a lot of commodity market interest and broader sort of financial market interest in taking a big position in those sort of what people will tend to think of as safe harbor markets. So when you couple that with a pretty robust fundamentals scenario for PGMs in particular, platinum, palladium, those markets, it's a pretty tempting pick if you're worried about the stock market and where we are with those environments.
Let's look at the commodity, of course, that dominates this part of the world, which is the oil market. And oil is doing pretty well at the moment. Looking at where we are now, Brent is $67 a barrel or thereabouts, trading pretty close to the highest level this year. What are the dynamics in the oil market?
Well, you know, oil's been on this roller coaster ride since October last year. And we saw this massive sell-off around the end of the year in 2018. And oil markets have worked hard to get back to where they are today. Unfortunately, if you're looking from the producer's perspective and you'd like a higher value, we're right back at those levels that trigger waves and waves of massive forward hedging from producers, particularly in the United States. So we got Brent at about 66. We got WTI, the U.S. market, at about 55, $10 behind, but at that kind of level where U.S. producers like to come in and hedge. So we're seeing a lot of winds coming into the market right now, really resisting a further move higher just at this moment. It's easy to forget, but the U.S. produces 12 million barrels a day of oil right now, which is astonishing. Of course, that number gets thrown around a lot. But what that means for these markets in a here and now today scenario is there's a lot of hedging that needs to get done. The last time U.S. producers felt this much wind in their sails, they forgot to hedge, and the markets made them pay for that.
Let's look at what happens to that 12 million figure from the United States, because it's been a game changer for the oil markets over the past decade, the rise of U.S. shale oil. And there are different reports. There are some reports that suggest that this is a long-term game changer. There are other reports that suggest it may be a short-term flash in the pan and that the U.S. cannot sustain 12 million barrels a day, really much past about 2023 or 2024. Which camp are you in, or are you in a different camp?
Well, I've become persuaded that the demise of U.S. shale is something that we need to not become too preoccupied with in the near term. You know, the reports of death of U.S. shale have been with us since U.S. shale was born 8 years ago, right? We've gone from 9 to 10 to 11 million barrels a day production. Now we're at 12. There's no doubting that the heart and soul of U.S. shale production, which is the Permian Basin down in Texas, is an astonishing reservoir that would rival anything in the world, and that has a long way to go. We don't even really know how much is truly there to be fracked away right now, so we have to work on the assumption that there's a lot more there than anybody can forecast right now.
I'm like a stuck record. You won't know this, but for the last 3 or 4 years, or since oil was at $26 a barrel about 3 or 4 years ago, I've been saying $70 by Christmas. Because for me, $70 is the kind of long-term equilibrium for the oil price. Keeps producers happy, it keeps consumers happy. Yeah. What's that number for you?
Yeah, I mean, our forecasts are not too far away from that ourselves, actually. And if you look at the way the markets rebounded from that big sell-off we mentioned earlier around the end of the year 2018, you can see that the markets are pivoting around that kind of a number over the medium term. If you look at the forward curves where markets are pricing today, much further forward in the market, 68 to 70 is that equilibrium number you're talking about. So there's a lot of observable evidence to support the theory. Now, here's the thing that I find interesting about that. You know, we mentioned Brent is 66. We mentioned TI is 56, 55. The really smart money in this market is on medium sour crude oil. That market, which tends to get a little bit overlooked sometimes, you know,
I'm guilty as charged.
No, but I mean, Dubai crude futures and the Dubai crude market, which is, of course, critical to ADNOC's production in Abu Dhabi and elsewhere. We mentioned the ADNOC rating yesterday. That market, medium sour crude, is doing phenomenally well. TI is 10 bucks cheaper than Brent, but medium sour crude, a dollar below. It's amazing, really, which means if you're a Gulf producer, it's a great place to be.
We've been speaking behind the scenes a lot to the guys at the DME, the Dubai Mercantile Exchange, and they have a crude future, the Oman crude futures. And they've always wanted this to be the benchmark. Their mantra is east of Suez.
Yeah.
From your perspective, you're not neutral in this game. S&P Global Platts is in the pricing game as well. But a contract like the Oman contract or the DME contract, how important is that?
Well, Platts Dubai and Platts Oman are currently the two most important medium sour crude benchmarks in the world. So you're absolutely right. We're a part of that dynamic. We publish those benchmarks today. And DME's Oman number is a sort of a competitor to ours in that regard. But one thing I think we can all agree on is I was talking about the importance of medium sour crude prices to both Gulf producers and the world market, by the way. Medium sour crude, pricing east of Suez, these are really hot button issues for the crude markets, and understanding those markets better and pricing them better is something that everybody's talking about right now, for sure.
What's your pick of the soft commodities in terms of maybe shortages over the next year, high prices?
Yeah, I think that the dynamics around soybeans going to China is a big story right now, and how that'll affect the price of soybean is something we're looking at very carefully as well between U.S. exports and Chinese imports. That's the one that I would keep a close eye on, along with Black Sea wheat, where there's a lot of activity right now. The growth in that market has been quite astonishing, actually. So those two are the ones we're keeping the closest eye on right now in terms of being most susceptible to gyrations in value, most bellwether in terms of what's going on with the economy and the food supply market. So those are the two we're looking at.
Finally, let's look at gold. Again, a very important commodity here in Dubai. We started with platinum.
Yep.
Gold, where do you see that heading?
Gold has been responding very bullishly to the same instability signals that have been underpinning some of the growth in platinum and palladium as well. And I see no reason for gold to come back off that stimulus anytime soon. So we're looking broadly positively towards the gold market. It's come a long way, but it's in a benign environment right now for potentially gaining more value, given how much uncertainty there is in the world, how much appetite and desire there is still to hedge that risk through gold is always going to be supportive in this kind of an environment.
So about 1350 now, 1358, which is a 10-month high.
Yeah.
It could go higher. There's upside potential.
There's always upside potential when the geopolitical space is like it is right now. There's always a little bit of upside potential. But bear in mind, it will be very responsive to any major progress in the China-U.S. talks in particular, stock markets recovering in particular. It will tend to have an inverse correlation to the U.S. stock market and global stock markets. So if those markets recover strongly, might expect the heat to come out of that just a little bit, but not a particular sign of that right now.
Great talking to you. Appreciate your time today. David Ernsberger is Global Head of Commodities Pricing at S&P Global Platts. Thanks for joining us today.
The Business Breakfast Nightcap
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hello, you're listening to the Business Breakfast Nightcap.
You and I have both picked on one man, the great and now late Karl Lagerfeld, who died yesterday, Malcolm, at the age of 85. You've been looking more at his cat than at Karl Lagerfeld himself, I know. But first of all, Lagerfeld.
Lagerfeld He was born in Hamburg. His mum, I think it was Swedish, or his dad, one of the two. He was half Swedish, half German anyway. And he effectively rescued Chanel. Many people say he rescued Chanel back in the 80s with his sort of strident designs. But the great and good of the fashion world, everybody's been coming out and sort of supporting him. Anna Wintour said that he was just the icon for her. Victoria Beckham has come out and praised him. Donatella Versace, Diane Kruger, they've all come out and said, look, that he was just the man. And in later life, I mean, to me, as somebody who doesn't really follow fashion very much, he looked just like a Bond villain, didn't he? He was a sort of the slightly old-fashioned looking suit, the white ponytail hair, the sort of crooked arm with the cat in it. You can just imagine him saying, yes, Mr. Bond, very interesting proposal.
Incredible individual. This is him. Let's hear from him now, talking to the guys at CNBC just a year or two ago. And they asked him about his legacy. What would be your legacy when you're gone? And this is how he responded.
But for, I will not be around for that, so who cares? Huh?
But you have given and still give so much to the industry.
As long as I don't repeat myself, that it's okay. You know, I laugh about myself. Huh? I'm my best cartoon.
One of my favourite quotes from his, and obviously people are trotting out these quotes, he says about himself, I am very much down to earth. Just not this earth. Most of the quotes we can't repeat, can we, Malcolm? You found
there's
a couple.
Lot of outrageous ones, really, to be honest with you. Yeah. Bernard Arnault, the chairman and CEO of LVMH, says the world has lost a creative genius with the death of Karl Lagerfeld. He says, we owe him a great deal. His taste and talent are the most exceptional I've ever known. He was dubbed Kaiser Karl and the Fashion Meister. He was worshipped in fashion circles around the world right up to his death. His mum, it was his mum that was German. His father was Swedish. He left Germany for France, for Paris in his early 20s. And of course, he is best known for his association with Chanel. Looking at some of those quotes that he's come up with, I'm trying desperately to pick out the ones that
While you do that, producer Shruti has picked out one of her favourites, and this is it.
I just do what my inner voices tell me. Huh? I'm the Joan of Arc of design.
I am the Joan of Arc of design.
I mean, he was basically outrageous, and he was rude. I'm trying to pick these quotes out here. I mean, this is what he said about people who complain about thin models. He says they're fat mummies sitting with their bags of crisps in front of the television saying that thin models are ugly. I mean, it's out there, isn't it? I mean, whether we should be reading this out or not. And the biting comments. He had a former friend, Inès de la Fressange, who was a Chanel muse, and he said, I wish her all the luck in the world, just so long as I don't have to see her anymore or hear her spoken about. And there are some very cutting comments, very edgy. And some of the edgiest ones, I have to say, I can't read out because they're also just over the top a little bit. He said on Heidi Klum, I don't know Heidi Klum. She's never been known in France. Claudia Schiffer doesn't know who she is either. On The Queen, he said, she looks a little bit like her grandmother, a bit more smiley perhaps. In terms of what she wears, she's come into herself a little bit more, whatever that is. And he was very himself. He didn't feel sort of constrained by mores of society. And he was Karl Lagerfeld. Of course, his cat is making as many headlines this morning as he is because he loved his cat, Choupette. He described her as a rich girl and an heiress, and it remains to be seen how much money goes to her. And you know, how many to his relatives. He never got married, didn't have children, so his more distant relatives. But Choupette the cat is actually kind of wealthy in her own right, really, because she's been modelling for car maker Vauxhall, Japanese cosmetic company, Shu Uemura. She's got money from that. She's also a foodie. She's an influencer in the cat food world. She has four different types of cat food a day, and she's got 159,000 followers on Instagram. So Choupette is wealthy in her own right and about to become a lot wealthier.
We've been getting the views of Manuel Arnault, who's the editor of Vogue Arabia. Looking at Karl Lagerfeld's impact globally, of course, on the fashion world, but also his impact on this country and this region. Of course, Vogue Arabia, based here in Dubai.
First of all, his designs are loved by the region. His couture collections at Chanel are loved by Arab women, and Chanel itself is a brand that Arab women love, also Fendi. So that idea of luxury and of doing beautiful collections that have the highest level of craftsmanship, it's something that really resembles with the Arab world. Karl Lagerfeld was actually in Dubai in 2014 for Chanel's cruise collection. And this was a big, big, big fashion event for the region, and that got everyone super excited. Also, regarding Vogue, we had the honor to have Karl Lagerfeld photographing our September 2017 September issue cover. It was our first ever September issue, and Karl Lagerfeld did an incredible job by portraying Bella Hadid in a way where the world has never seen her. And by shooting her with beautiful Fendi modest outfits, he kind of like started a conversation about the sartorial choices of the region and even the way that Arab women were seen worldwide. We got an incredible coverage worldwide. It was featured in the New York Times, in the Women's Wear Daily. So it was really important for the world to see the Arab world through the lenses of Karl. And I'm super excited and very proud and honored that Karl Lagerfeld chose such a young publication as Vogue Arabia to showcase his work as photographer.
That's the voice of Manuel Arnaud. He is the editor of Vogue Arabia. His thoughts on Karl Lagerfeld, who's died at the age of 85.
The Business Breakfast Nightcap.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hi, you're listening to The Business Breakfast Nightcap. Tim Swain is Managing Director of Nomad Media TV, and he joined us to discuss their secret to making money from Fighting Fit Dubai, which has now switched from OSN to ESPN. Why did the programme migrate from OSN to ESPN?
ESPN are the worldwide leader in sports. Fighting Fit is a homegrown sports reality show, an award-winning show, so it felt like a very natural fit to team up with ESPN on this season. The other very important thing for us is we're changing the show from what was your typical one-hour-long linear show, and now we're taking it completely digital. So all the episodes will be on ESPN.com. It will be 3 episodes a week, sort of 8 to 10 minutes long, and people can follow the show real time. There's no paywall. Yeah, anyone can watch it anywhere in the world, and it just reflects, you know, much more how people are consuming content these days. And we're an innovative show. ESPN are an innovative broadcaster, so it's just a good fit for us.
Does that mean you won't be broadcast as part of their regular sort of linear broadcasting?
Not here in the region. So here in the region...
In the Far East, perhaps?
Potentially. So what ESPN are looking to do with the show is do a localised version here, but what's got them interested is potentially taking the show to other regions, so doing potentially a Fighting Fit Singapore or other areas where there's a big boxing community. So what they really see is also the importance of localized content. So this is a homegrown brand that people in Dubai know, so it helps ESPN build affinity with the local viewership here in the region.
So can I just understand this correctly, that you're not going to get the sort of the programming, the daily programming of the show? It is only online?
Absolutely, yeah.
And how does that rate in terms of viewings compared to if you were being shown on the television?
Yeah, I mean, look, we feel like it will be a real boon to the show, to be honest with you. I mean, ESPN, just in the MENA region alone, have millions of page views a month. They also have millions of video views a month. So we already, by putting it online, access that straight away. It's free, so anyone can watch it. So I think viewership-wise, it's going to be great for the show.
How much is this franchise worth for your company?
I mean, I can't really talk into specifics on the franchise value. The way our model works is we'll work with a broadcaster like ESPN, but we have a number of revenue streams on the show. Particularly, we have a number of partners. So we partner with Adidas, we're partnering with Adol this season, we're partnering with Fuel Up by KCAL. So a lot of our finance streams come from them. And there's a number of ways they get value out of the show, from product placement, brand integration, and all of that that comes with it. So that's sort of how our model works on a show like this.
Well, Tim, we'll talk more about the changing business model of what we all know as television. But first of all, we'll hear from one of the previous episodes of Fighting Fit Dubai. I know the program because I've had friends who've taken part in it. You may recognize the voice of the commentator on this.
Dubai, a city built on ambition, a workforce all wanting success. People, professions, companies, all in fierce competition to make it to the top. And now a competition of a different nature challenges Dubai's workforce.
Chris McCarty from Off Script there. So the business model is, it can work two ways. You sell the content to ESPN and they make money off the advertising, or is it you simply make money on the advertising from the likes of Gelfar, the drug company, and Adidas, and you give the content away free to ESPN?
Yeah, it's a little bit more collaborative with ESPN than that. So they're providing some pre-production support for us. They're providing all of the tech support to host the content, and they're also amplifying the content. So it's more of a co-production on their side. But yeah, our revenue streams is very much a sponsor-driven show, and we're giving, you know, our partners, as you mentioned, Adidas, Adol, KCAL, access to, you know, a completely new way of reaching their audiences.
What does it cost to produce this kind of content? We've had the guys from Stars play in, and they've said they're not going to produce local content. It's just too expensive. They say that for drama, it's kind of Netflix-style dramas, cost between $200,000 and $1 million an hour to produce. Now, I'm guessing this reality TV content is cheaper than that, although Chris, I'm sure, isn't cheap. But how do the economics stack up?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. That, like, drama obviously is an expensive production, because you've got the actors and all of the talent and the setups and the studios. So reality and sports reality like this is a much cheaper form of production, because our talent are just everyday people like you and I who want to get on the show and get fit. So I can't probably tell you exact specifics, but we're a lot less an hour than something like that Mars at Star Place talked about.
So revenue coming from perhaps advertising, sponsorship payments, product placement, social media influencing, etc. Rights for the programme now been picked up in Africa and Asia. How valuable are those rights to you?
Yeah, absolutely. So they're a second run for us. So the way we look at it is a holistic approach. So our revenue streams come from, as I say, the sponsors who want to get involved in the show, or the partners. We have also an event, an awarding event, where the competitors will, fight at the end of the season. That's a revenue stream for us. And then finally, we can repackage and repurpose the content for sales in other territories.
For somebody who hasn't seen the program before, what sort of fighting is it?
So the guys, we take everyday people from Dubai. They need to be aged between 25 and 57. And the only thing is that they've never boxed before. And it's all about, getting real people. It's 50% men, 50% women, fit, active, change their lives. So we just want to find people who want to change, who want to have reasons to get fit, and want to have reasons for getting involved in the show. So
Richard Dean kind of fits into that character.
Absolutely, yeah. I think he's just within the age range.
So not one, but okay. Two shoulder injuries down. And I wasn't much of a boxer before that.
Hey, before we let you go, Tim, what's next? Because what's on the back burner? I'm sure that you're under pressure to keep that conveyor belt of production constantly churning to find new product.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is a big thing. This is going to consume us for the next 2 months, producing this show. We do a lot of work with, the brands around the region, just on typical sort of corporate work. But yeah, we've got a couple of documentaries planned for later in the year. We're looking at doing some stuff around the Year of Tolerance. And we're also looking at some stuff around heritage sports that we do as well. So yeah, lots to do. Very, very busy year.
Tim Swain, thanks very much indeed for joining us. We do appreciate it. The Managing Director of Nomad Media TV, the production company behind Fighting Fit Dubai. We do appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
The Business Breakfast Nightcap
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Thank you for listening. We are back on The Business Breakfast proper tomorrow, 6 a.m. Have a really good evening.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.